Welcome, everyone, to Keep Hope Alive, starring yours truly, Tony DeRillis. This podcast is about a genuine, authentic experience about a young man navigating the foster care system and making it to the other side, defying statistics. This podcast covers former and current foster youth, not just in New York City, but across the country. Tony shares all of what's happening in foster care to uplift and empower foster youth, foster parents, agency staff, and social workers. Keep hope alive. Until next time.
Yo, what is going on, everybody? It is Tony DeRillis back here with another podcast episode. We got a great guest today. Super honored to have her on here. Just strong black woman of faith and conviction, mother of two young boys, married with her husband, got her bachelor's of science degree in criminal justice administration, and her master's of science in human and social services. Founder and CEO of Fear Everything and Rise, and just a phenomenal human being in general, right? So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I introduce Alicia Wilson.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for having me.
Of course. How you feeling today?
I'm good. You know, I'm over COVID. It's time to get back in society and just be able to do some of the things we used to do, at least, right? Most of all, the homeschooling killing me. Two kids, like, different needs. This isn't working, Mom. That isn't working. It's just crazy. But outside of that, everything is pretty good. Pretty good.
Okay. Hey, listen, I felt that on a spiritual level just now. Like I'm ready to get back up after what it's almost been a year now, just about.
Since so
I'm ready. but yeah, like as y'all know, you see from the title here in the description, this is gonna be the official interview of Fear Everything and Rise. Here we go. The Fear Everything and Rise book. I have a lot of questions. And yeah, we just gonna get right into it. So I'm not gonna lie, like just getting into like the first paragraph, like the very first paragraph just like blew me away, honestly, right? Because it was February 5th was one of the coldest days in New York City. Being born to a heroin addicted mother and alcoholic father in the Bronx was just the very beginning of many years to come. Now for me, like, when I read that, I was like, damn, like that just like instantly drew me in because I was just like that's real. Like, I want to know more now. Like, so what was that like intentional or just like I was just speaking from the heart?
I think it was both. I think it was intentional, but I feel like it was also speaking from the heart because a lot of times people like, they have this misconception of where I'm from, right? Because I've lived in Long Island, New York. I lived in Queens, Brooklyn. So a lot of times I feel like I have to make it known that I'm a boogie down, uptown girl. I've just been in so many different homes and placements that I've lived in different areas. But I wanted people to understand like all of my trauma and heartache, it came from the Bronx, right? It started in the Bronx. And as I maneuvered through life and started learning the truth of what was then, now, you know, I've just learned to embrace my roots and where I was from and learn to say it's okay to be from uptown.
Okay.
You think about, you know, people say bad stuff. Oh, yeah, drug addicts, rapists, all kinds of stuff. And I wanted to let them know that there's some good rooted people that come from the boogie down, don't sleep on us. So that was intentional, but I also needed to let people know.
Okay. I appreciate that. Cause yeah, that's interesting. Like, you know, having that sense of shame about like your upbringing, but then like later on embracing that too. Right. And just being like, yo, this is where I'm from. Like, I'm not going to shy away from that. So I appreciate that. And then the other thing too, I kind of want to like kind of get into some of the, just the transition from when you first, like, your parents kind of separated and just like the feelings and things that kind of came up there, because, which I know long time ago, but I'm sure there was like a lot of difficulty in just like how you were able to process all that.
So the process was difficult, right? Because I was born in 1984. My journey started in foster care in 1988 when my mom got sick. My mom passed away from HIV. She was a drug, you know, a drug addict, and she used needles a lot. So when I began my transition, it really started at the age of four. I went to live with my aunt in Harlem. From there, I stayed there almost a year. And then I transitioned into the foster care system. And that's where everything happened. I was placed out of Manhattan Family Court. And from there, I went into a RTC because there was nowhere to place me. And at this time, I'm like five, so I'm the youngest kid in the RTC, right? And I started with one agency, New York Fallon, and then I transitioned through some other ones, SCO, and then ended up with Little Flower. And by the time I got to Little Flower from New York Fallon and SCO, I had already been in maybe like five different homes. So now to go into Little Flower, that started a whole new transition of five homes to ending up in 2005, aging out, reaching 63. So I think a lot of times people don't understand when we talk about transitions, there's a lot that go on with transitions and youth that are, you know, going through the foster care system. So okay. I've had some good transitions, but I've also had a lot of bad ones. The bad transitions remind me of moving place to place with garbage bags, right? That right there is the number one mind blower. It's so bad now that even in my adult life, I don't let trash pile up in my house. Like, I take it out immediately. And I think it's a trauma that I'm still dealing with at the age of 37, which is part of my transition, right? So this road has been hectic, but I feel like it's been worth it. To get to this very moment of where I'm at and doing what I'm doing, I wouldn't trade it for nothing. So yeah, many transitions, many different paths and different routes, but I made it, I'm here. So yeah.
No, for sure. And I kind of want to go back to the residential treatment center, right? Because I feel like there was a lot there. One thing that you said that like really stood out to me in page 8, where it was like, I stayed in my bed most of the time wondering if my parents were going to rescue me from this misery. Now, the reason why that kind of stood out to me was because I was 16 years old when I was in a residential treatment facility. I was in Goldsmith over there in Hawthorne, New York. So, like, for me, even at that age, I'm thinking to myself, like, damn, like, I tend to daydream a lot, especially when I was younger, because I always fantasized about, it helped me escape the really bad situation I was in, right? And oftentimes I would think to myself like, wow, I just wish like my father would just randomly reach out to me and say like, hey, I miss you, like I wanna take you back. Or, you know, my mother would just change her ways, right? And it was all this, even though I was cognitive of what happened, I still, deep down inside, I still wanted that love and that comfort and that warmness from my real parents. And even though there was some people that, I don't want to say imitate, but some people that, you know, gave me that, you know, in dosages, it still wasn't the real thing. You know what I'm saying? So I feel like I really resonated with that one, because I was just like, you hitting the feels right there, Felicia, you know? But I'm curious, like, did you also kind of go through a lot of like daydreaming as well as a way of coping and just kind of getting through your situation?
Being in RTC, I can say the best thing about being in RTC was that I was five, right? And I was the youngest. All these teenagers and stuff, I was the youngest. So I got the special treatment, right? But to be in an environment where there was so many different personalities, you're talking about on an emotional level, it was just like new to me, right? Because I'm like, at five, you don't really know what emotions are and how to channel, you know, your emotions and things like that. So to see different girls go through different things, I'm like, this can't be life. So I felt like, you know, my safe haven was just to stay in my room and daydream and hope that someone would come forward to claim me, right? Or just say like, she's mine, you know, like you said, you talk about your father coming, you know, hoping that he would come and rescue you. I felt that same way, like, well, damn, I gotta be loved. I can't be out here in the world by myself. Somebody will come. But unfortunately, no one ever did. I ended up actually engaging in some of the negative behaviors of our young people that were in the RTC, the group home environment. I was running away. At times I was jumping out of windows, because when you see, when you're in an environment where you see certain behaviors, it become a norm. If someone guiding you to tell you that's inappropriate or that's not right. So I was I found myself engaging in some of the negative things that the older girls were doing. But I can honestly say when they would see me do it, they would tell me like, this isn't the life you want, right? You need to go back to the dorm, like stop following us, things like that. So I think in that moment, although they were doing stuff that they shouldn't have been doing, at least they saw me as the little sister or the youngin' that can change things, don't follow them. So those are some of the things I've experienced. No structure, you know, same old, same old. What happens in group homes and residential treatment facilities? Medication, they medicate you. And a crazy thing was, when I was in the RTC, I was diagnosed with depression. I didn't talk for a long time, for almost like 3 years. So they thought like I was going through severe depression. It wasn't that I was going through severe depression. I just didn't feel like being bothered with nobody. I wanted to soak in my emotions and all that I was going through and just hoping somebody would come, and no one ever did. So I embarked on that journey for a little while, and it was what it was.
I definitely agree with just how you become like almost a product of your environment, and like the things you see kind of shape and mold you, right? Because I remember when I was in an RTF as well, and I think you could probably relate to this as well, when, you know, reading the book, but there was a lot of fights, right? There was a lot of She's like, oh, here we go. For me, like, I'm not a fighter, right? Like, I'm not a person that gets riled up. But a lot of people in my environment were aggressive. So by default, I'm like, yo, I got to protect myself. Like, I can't be going out here like a chump. So, you know, I fought too. Even if that's not my natural state. That's not who I am as a person. But being in that environment just kind of created that in me, right? So, you know, I often felt like a lot of times I had to like fight for my life, you know, and just like, yo, if no one else is gonna protect and defend me, I gotta do what's right for me, you know. So that definitely takes a toll on you. And I think a little bit earlier too, you mentioned like the garbage bags, right? And just like how that kind of relates to some of the further trauma, like just further down the road, even in your adult life, right? Because I know for me, I felt oftentimes that, okay, like once I turned 21, once I aged out of foster care, a lot of the stuff I thought would just disappear, right? Like, I'm just like, oh, that's the past. Where's my broom? Just
right.
It's over. I don't got to live in fear no more, right? Yeah. But a lot of times, I still have a thing with garbage bags too. One of the most humiliating moments for me was when I got my own apartment, and I will never forget this. I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember getting two big garbage bags from my aunt's house and just hauling it all the way from East Flatbush to Long Island City, New York, and hauling two big garbage bags. And I didn't have enough money to get a cab, because I was working part time. I was just barely affording the rent. So But I remember the humiliation and the embarrassment of holding two garbage bags and having to go to the bus and the train with holes in the garbage bags. And I'm just like, damn, like, even after 20 years, I guess nothing changed, like, you know, from foster care to adult. So, like, that just kind of, like, weighed on me. I was like, oh, man, like, is this what it's always going to be? So, I don't know. That just kind of brought me back, you know, just some thoughts on that. But, yeah, I went to, I'm kind of rambling here. I know you said I stayed in my bed most of the time. Oh, no. I often wondered what I did to deserve so much love that a family would want me. On page 12, once you were leaving the cottage, right? And that part kind of hit me too, because it's like, you, it just came from such a sincere point and authentic, genuine, like, concern. Like, am I even good enough to deserve love? It kind of felt like, can you, like, kind of just further expand on that too? Because to me, I was just like, to be so young and have those thoughts is like, that's deep.
Well, to expand on it, when I reflected back on that page, it was coming from a place where it was like, okay, I'm leaving the RTC, and this is my second RTC, and this RTC that I was leaving was with Little Flower and Wading River. And I remember when they had the open house, and they had told me, like, you know, we found a placement for you. And I was just like, placement? Like, don't nobody want this throwaway kid? Like, I'm here where I don't have nobody claiming me. So it's just like, someone want to change my life that much. Like, they believe in me to some extent to where they're willing to rescue me. Why poor little old me? And I never forget when I actually got to the foster home. I never forget, she came and got me for a weekend. But they would do it differently back then than I see the way it's done now. Back then, when you were in the RTC, the foster parent would come. They would do a day visit with you. Then the day visit would turn into a weekend visit, right? Then the weekend visit would turn into the go to your new home, you know, which should be the last placement for you. And I remember when this foster parent first came, I was just like, what is it so special about me that I deserve for somebody to want to come get me if my own parent didn't even want me? Back then, when you see that you're separated from your parents, it's a different thought that goes through your head, right? But as you get older, you start to really understand the magnitude of, it's not that your parents threw you away. So if they threw you away, then why should somebody want you? Sometimes it's what's going on in our parents' lives that they have no control over. Drugs is a heavy thing, right? It's something that's not easy to navigate once a person becomes subjected to it and prone to using. So I had to learn that as I got older. But in that moment, I'm just like, what's so special about little old me? Like, I don't deserve this. Like, my own mother and father couldn't give me love. You know, they couldn't treat me or give me what every normal child should have, which is a home, a loving mother and father to raise them together in that home. So when I had a foster parent come forth and take me and my brother, I was just like, what is love? Like, why me? Like, why did they choose me? But now that I'm older, I understand that some people do it because they really love the kids, but there were other people that do it because it's a money thing for them. I've been in some homes where they really love me and it was just me cutting up and acting a fool. But I've been in some homes too where they can tell you, when you're not here, I don't get paid for when you're not here. And I'm like, that ain't love, you know? So when I reflect back on things like that, I'm just like, love is what you perceive it to be, but it's that emotional connection that you have from person to person, right? If I'm calling if I'm calling somebody a mother format, if I'm calling a mother in a mother form, if I'm calling somebody a brother or sister, it's because there's that connection there, in which I feel an emotional attachment for my greater good. Not just saying it to say, because you can give anybody a title, but there needs to be that connection. So when I look at it now compared to like back then, I'm just like, I really fully understand what love is. And now I feel like there are people in my life that really appreciate me and want me there for the right reasons. And I'm able to pick up on it. So when it don't look like love, look, I don't have no problem walking away. I'm okay with that. And it is what it is.
So, yeah. Yeah. Yo, I feel like that really comes from like a place of empathy too. Being able to like realize that your parents really weren't in the best place to fully support and love on you. And to just kind of come to that conclusion where like, I don't fault you. Like, you know, it unfortunately it's a bad circumstance, but like making peace with it, right? And I know you said like that process happened for you when you were older, but like, and then you kind of delved a little bit into like love, but like, what did self-love and true in the true healing process look like for you?
It's funny that you asked that, because I'm in that phase of life now, right? I think when we look at some of the traumas and the things that we go through, we say we know what love is, but do we really understand it and really know what it is? I had to learn that love can come from different people. And if even they don't know how to love you, then how can they really say they love you? And as I started looking at it from that angle, I started questioning myself on what do you really know about love? And I had to learn that love is something that grows over time. And there's a process, right? And I've learned through my healing process, even that I'm on now, is that I'm learning to not just like myself more, but I'm learning to really nourish me. Really understanding the concept of love and what it entails, what it feels, what it looked like. So even with my children, when I look at them, I see love, right? Because I'm nurturing that bond between them and me, but I'm also able to tell them what makes me love them that much more. So I'm just learning. There's a process in love and healing, and it doesn't automatically come. It's something that you constantly work at day to day. I look myself in the mirror every day and I tell myself why I love me. I tell myself I deserve to be loved. I tell myself that I deserve to give it back as well. So for me, it's just an ongoing process. It never changes. And that's what my second book is about, right? It's called Holding Water. You Truly Never Know a Woman. Because I feel like we go through all of these phases of life. We go through all of these emotions. But if we don't grasp the concept of what it looks like, how can we really heal through it? So for me, I had to learn part of loving me was healing the broken girl and the grown woman. A lot of people don't want to admit to that, right? I can't be out here telling our young people or our foster parents or our administration, like, you know, love on these kids and do this and do that. But I'm not following my own words in my healing journey. So for me, love is something that is an ongoing process in your healing journey. And I'm in my healing journey. I'm not afraid to say that. Last year was the first time. My mother's been deceased since 1988, and last year was the first time I've literally forgave her for all of the mistakes, the choices, everything. And like I said, I'm 37. My mother died when I was 4, and I just forgave her at 36. So that's a process that is ongoing constantly. I'm learning to love me through my healing, and that's the space I'm in.
Wow. No, thank you for sharing that. I think it's funny. Sometimes when I hear the healing process, I feel like oftentimes people think it's like, and maybe sometimes it is like this evolutionary process that might happen. Everyone's healing process looks different.
Mine was
ugly. I feel like,
I said my healing process is an ugly process because it, when you go through healing, you are put in a position where you're challenged to face the dark realities, whether it's something good or something bad. And I think for me, with my children having, you know, their issues with mental health, like ADHD and things like that, and some other stuff going on, they really pushed me to a position where it's just like, we're going to make you face the reality of what you need to heal. So I felt like all of the stuff that I buried in the mud, right, I would be good because I don't got to face it. But having my children, oh, it's a whole different ballgame. And I feel like raising an 8 and a 9-year-old, they had to go through some things for me to even realize as a mother, like, you're really not healed. And your children and what they're doing and going through is showing you you're not healed because you don't know how literally to maneuver through. You're letting your emotions get the best of you. You're letting your frustration show. You're letting your anger show. And when I hit, I think about when my kids, they're 8 and 9. So when they were 4 and 5, I literally hit rock bottom, like in a mental space where I would isolate, right? And people didn't know what was going on because I was just so closed in. I was afraid and ashamed to talk about it. But then as I started going through therapy with them and for myself, I started realizing there's beauty in healing. Never be ashamed of the process because someone else is waiting on you and your story and your transition to show up visually for them to take on those same challenges and not be afraid. So my kids, realistically, they forced me to heal and I'm still going through it with them within myself. So it's a beautiful feeling though. Yeah.
That's something. Cause yeah, I feel like there's, I feel like there might be some young person listening to this right now, and they probably thinking to themselves, "Yo, Miss, like, you talking about all this healing stuff, and that's nice, but I feel broken right now. Like, what are you going to do about that?" I'm just keeping it real, right? There might be someone that's like, "Okay, I mess with Tony DeRillis, but you know, I'm not an author. I'm not a host of a podcast. Like, what can I do, right?" What would you tell people? What would you tell young people like right now that are just in a state of brokenness and in just a dark place where they don't see hope, right? I preach keep hope alive, and I do stand by it, but I know there's some people that feel like, yo, hope ain't gonna get me out of my situation. But I'm just curious on your thoughts on like what that looks like for you.
Oh man. For me, for a long time, I didn't see hope, right? And it's so funny that you asked that question because I would always lash out and say, "You don't know what it's like to be a foster kid. You don't know what it's like to be a latchkey kid, a throwaway kid." And there were genuine people that would come along and tell me what I needed to do. But I knew too, them telling me that, it was a reason they were telling me. But I was just so angry, right? So I didn't care to hear what nobody else said until I got older and I became that teenager and I realized like life was changing. And it was passing me by, right? Mm-hmm. So I started taking little steps like self-acknowledgement, right? I think when young people can't see the end of the road or what they want their lives to look like or end up, they go into that shell, right? They go into that shell of beating themselves up. And my words to them is to just acknowledge that you're in a place where it looks dark, but that don't have to be the end all of your chapter or end all of your life. Like you put up a post on Facebook regarding something about foster care is just a part of your life, right? It's not the end all. Acknowledge the space that they're in.
It's just a chapter, not the book.
Right, it's just a chapter. And what I started doing was, I started, like when I was going through so many things at that time, I would literally surround myself with people, right? And people that I'm still friends with since 10th grade through college, through life, and we still real good friends. I would surround myself with them and their families to kind of get a feeling of what my life can look like as I establish these things and get it out the mud, get it out the dirt and work on them. So for me, I would tell them, hang on. Self-acknowledgement is key. It's important. But surround themselves with people that model what they want, right? But be realistic about it in the process. So if you know you want to be a millionaire, you're not going to hang around broke folks. You know what I mean? You're going to want to hang around people that's about stacking their bread and coming up. If you want to get a good education, you know, whatever it is, a good job, hang around people that are educated. Hang around people that are educators. Align yourself with the people that you aspire to be or surround yourself in a population of people and things that are doing where you're trying to go. So for me, that's what hope looked like for me. Like, you don't have to settle in the dirt on your own. There are people that come from where you come from. There are people that are doing what you're doing. But surround yourself with those people so that you can see how they're doing it to overcome and then implement, incorporate some of those things into your own life. So.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, because I think there's, I forget the saying, but something about like the five people closest to you or that you surround yourself with, you end up being like core of that, right? So I definitely resonate with like surrounding yourself around positivity and uplifting and empowerment, right? Because these things, they're the foundation of a healthy lifestyle, right? And I do believe that people that, you know, come from our background can heal in a healthy manner, right? We don't have to cope by using drugs or substances or, you know, just set, like having sex to fill a void in our life or gambling, right? All these things that that just end up being a real downward spiral in our life. And yeah, I mean, I know it's possible. I know I felt many times where I'm like, yo, this is it. This is gonna, I'm not sure if I'm gonna get through, but God had other plans for me, right? And that's actually something, you know, and that's an interesting segue too, because I feel like the further I got along in your book, the more it kind of felt like your faith in God kind of like increased a bit. Is that correct to say, at least?
It is correct to say. I remember having foster parents that were Christians and they believed in raising their children a certain way. And I never forget, it was one foster mother I had, Lisa. She was so big in the church. Like, we went in choir rehearsal, we went to Bible study, we were going through all of these different things within religion and her showing us that there's a higher power and your life is the way that it is because God knew what he was doing. He made no mistake. So as I journeyed through life and I was going through all of these difficult times and things like that, the one thing I've always learned going to church and through her was that when you don't know anything else to do, the one thing you can do is always confide in God and drop to your knees and pray. And I had to learn that prayer was just that heart-to-heart conversation with you and God, no one else. And it was like the more I incorporated some of the religious things I was taught through this one foster parent, I felt comfort in going back to that one thing that was consistent, which was God and the Bible, right? And I'm just like, as I started maneuvering and getting older, I was just like, well, when this gets rough, what do? You don't give up. You find a different route to take and you keep God at the forefront of that route. You have those conversations with him. You talk to him, you give it to him, you know, don't sit in it too long because then your mind becomes affected by it. So as I learned to, you know, just maneuver through whatever situation I was going through, I started realizing like he was my best friend, right? God became my best friend. Mm-hmm. To the point where it was just like, I stopped running because I used to be a runner. I used to run from all my problems, everything. I was just a huge runner. And when I reached that place of breakdown mode, I had to allow my life to collapse in order for it to be built back up just to get where I'm at today. So whatever that included, you know, not having enough food in the refrigerator to cook to eat, going through hard times, you know, placement to placement, whatever it was, it has brought me to a place where it's like when all else fails, I know God always got me. And I'm proud that she introduced me, my foster mother Lisa introduced me to God, because even now I'm incorporating it into my children's lives and they have questions everywhere. And I knew that I was making an influence on them because my 9-year-old said to me last year, he was like, Mommy, you know Solomon was the wisest man in the Bible, right? Do you know, like, David wrote the whole book of Psalms? He sinned one time. And in that moment, I realized that the foundation that was given to me through a foster parent that believed in God, I'm now incorporating it into my children's lives. And they have that foundation. So I'm just like, that's all I know to do. And I encourage people to seek whatever it is that they're seeking through a higher power. Put their faith in something greater than them. So, yeah.
Okay. I like that. Because for me, I got saved 2 years ago, but I know for me also it was a process where there was times where I was just mad at God, right? And I'm just like, how could you do this? Why would you allow such a terrible life, right? And I didn't realize, obviously, that there was bigger plans for me, right? So it's really, as cliche as it sounds, trust in the process, right? And really digging deep and having faith that it's not us that guides our path, but really God. So I appreciate you for sharing that little tidbit right there. Let's get into like some of the inspiration for the story, for the book in general. Like what made you kind of just sit down and be like, you know what? I need to write this book about my life and just like have other people know about it. Cause I feel like that's a huge step.
I never forget when I was working in government, right? And I wasn't able to share my story because they would constantly tell us like, you know, the young people shouldn't know your business, your personal life. You need to keep work and business, you know, your business and your personal life separate. And I remember one day this young person, we got into detention, and she had this conversation with me. She ended up coming in foster care, but she told me one day, she said, Ms. Wilson, she said, you know what, she said, I don't care about the physical scars, she said, because over time, she said, the scars disappear. But she said, the emotional and verbal abuse is what bothers me. That's what stays. She said, because I really believe that I'm going to be a drug addict like my mother. I believe I'm going to go into prostitution like my mother, because people are constantly saying that. And this was happening in and out of foster homes. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I knew. And at this time, it was about 2012, 2013. And in that moment right there, I started planning how I was going to leave, right? How I was going to make my story worthwhile and change the dynamics for young people to share their stories on their journey. And I can honestly say that 2015 was when I actually sat down and began to write my story. Because I realized in that moment that it was young people, like the young lady I had these conversations with while working in detention, was crying out for someone to rescue her. And in that moment of her crying out for someone to rescue her, I was stuck in how I'm going to rescue me. So I felt like sharing my story with the world was the first step to rescuing myself, but to also bring people along my journey of this thing called life, to see that I may have been different than you and you didn't know, because although I appeared to be a normal person, right? Like I had my a mother, father background, all of that stuff. You never knew unless I shared it with you. So I felt like it was time to give those people that I called friends and people I said I love a glimpse of who Felicia really is. And I knew writing this story would do that, and help people embrace young people like us that come from the background of foster care. So for me, having this young lady express that, I wanted to be the vision and a goal of hope for her. So sharing my story, it has actually led to business opportunities and amongst other amazing platforms. So
Let's get into that too, right? Because I know you're a huge advocate of having young people share their stories, and just having an opportunity to present that. So like, obviously, I know we you got that event coming up. I believe young people are the artisan of their own story or something of that sort. I forget the exact title. Okay. Yeah, tell me a little bit more about it.
Artisan of their own story.
Ah, okay. Explain like what made you wanna start that event.
I felt like, you know, there are great organizations out there doing amazing things for young people. But one of the things that often annoyed me was that these programs are out here and many of our young people don't know they exist.
Yeah.
Right? They don't know that they exist. I started hearing young people say they were tired of people saying they understand, they can relate. And in that moment, I was just like, you know what the issues are. You know what the concerns are. You know some of the things you had to face, you know, through your phase of independent living into adulthood. Mm-hmm. Why not create a platform for us, by us, right? To help young people understand that this is what success can look like. Coming from somebody that has already maneuvered the system, has reached the level of success and different areas of life. So I wanted to create an organization that wasn't happening in New York City by alumni of foster care for the foster youth that are transitioning the system and beyond. And that's what this event is about. It's about notifying young people that they're not alone in their process. They actually have the supports and the means of people that have gone through the system just like they have, that can help them land their feet on solid ground and work through life issues, life situations, and be the tour guide, be the GPS system with whatever supports put in place to get them to the place of independency, but also navigating adulthood from an alumni perspective. There'll be so many different programs. Like, we know what these kids need. And, you know, we've been doing this for 30, 40 years. Okay, so then the outcome should be different, right? A lot of our young people shouldn't be facing homelessness. A lot of our graduation rate should be a lot higher if we're instilling education. Things like that, right? We can't teach our young people that they need to become leaders, right? If they don't even know where to start within personal development, because it starts with self first, right? You can't help somebody until you learn to help yourself, right? So I realized a lot of these things were missing. And the young people didn't know. They know that there are people that have gone through the system like them, but how many of them understand and can visually see the success behind someone that has came from where they're at or where they're coming from and where they're trying to go. So I just felt like it was a system that was needed. It was a program that was needed. And that's where we are. We'll be launching April 2nd from 1:30 to 4. We'll have some amazing speakers on talking about housing, how to get connected with housing. We have some speakers coming on from Lawyers for Children. We have some speakers coming on to help young people navigate mental health issues. We'll also be talking about educational development, and educational leadership, like the responsibilities of people within their different areas or different fields, and how they're supposed to help foster youth navigate the system. So that's where we are.
Okay. No, I'm loving it because I think it's really just about filling a niche and something that's much needed, right? Because outside of this event, I really haven't seen anything on this level that really just puts the young people at the forefront, right? And really allows them to get the opportunities they deserve. Because in my opinion, I feel like our stories are worth a lot, right? And I'm gonna just say it, right? Like a lot of agencies, they'll give you like $10-$20 gift card. That's cute, but
right.
We need some money. You know what I'm saying? And like we're giving our heartfelt stories, you know, of trauma, pain, hardships, right? It's not easy. That's a lot of work, right? And I believe, I think, or you know, any of that, I believe that we need to change that paradigm. We need to change that shift where it's like, yo, we really getting paid for our work, for our story, for our testimony. So,
yeah. And that's why I feel like in every aspect of what people like you and I know our young people suffer with, right, when transitioning out, we have somebody that can guide them with finances. This person is legit, certified, licensed, mm-hmm. everything, that's willing to come in and work with our young people on how to establish bill credit, what happens in the apartment process. They literally take our young people through savings, the different saving accounts, life insurance, long-term invest, like how to do long-term investing, just starting with simple things like a penny, right? I wish somebody would have told me you could buy into stocks and things like that with just pennies, because I probably would be a millionaire. You might be a millionaire right now, right? So we have somebody on every level, teaching them how to advocate, you know, teaching them the housing process. A lot of times you'll have a lot of young people leave foster care and they're just like, well, I did my housing a year ago. We need to really look at what's happening in New York City and be realistic. If we're going to battle the issue of homelessness, and you know New York City has a lot of homelessness, we have to make sure we start this process anywhere from 2 to 3 years prior to aging out, not a year. Right. And we need to be able to make sure that the agencies are following up or partner with the agencies to see how we can take some of that pressure off of them to help the young people maneuver and go where they need to go. So
that's so true.
In every aspect of life, there's someone that is there to guide them. And that's what we focus on.
Yeah, it confuses me. That we haven't had something on that level as of yet. And I'm just like, yo, like, there's just so much, like, even whether it's having siblings stay together in the system, right, and not separating, whether it's finding out if there's a relative that can take them as opposed to just going from foster home to foster home, like, or just more mentorship programs that are like guiding and supporting young people. And there's like a sort of where it's not so fragmented and disjointed, right? Where like there's more stuff happening and it's more seamless. So I do have my own reservations and my own frustrations with it, but I'll just say that I'm excited that there's an organization that's really putting this together, right? And really just teaching essential skills that you're going to need for like for a lifetime. So,
yeah. And I think it's good also to understand that it is an organization of color. With everything that's going on in the world now, we need to have leadership change within these organizations, within these government entities. And I always say part of changing the system is to incorporate the people that come from it, right? You'll never be able to fix it completely. But if you incorporate alumni and a lot of these leadership position, leadership roles, they can really start working with higher up to teach them and show them how to navigate it. A lot of times I always say, like, okay, it's always, experience is a beautiful thing, but if you don't have the full round package, how can you tell these young people what they need to do or what they should be doing? So I feel like once we become incorporated as alumni into higher up positions and work with the appropriate people that can help make things happen, we're going to maintain in a broken system. And that's why I feel like What About Us is a platform now where we can literally come together and be the bridge to gap everyone, bridge them together and fill the gap for them to see, like, the individuals that are affected by this organization are people of color, which we already know. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're making a statement. And the statement is, we need to prepare ourselves to put people in positions that look like our young people so that they can see what success can look like. And that's part of helping them create and become the artisans of their story. You know, we have to be in positions so that they can see that, oh, that person looks like me. That person represents what I aspire to be and to do. So I think until a lot of organizations are willing to do that, you know, whether it's government entities, nonprofits, the system will, you know, it'll remain a little broken. So I pray that, and I hope that What About Us can help organizations bridge the gap.
No, that's real.
And that's what we
like. Like being able to see other people that look like you kind of gives that sense of like, yo, okay, now like I feel more. And it's just like statistics and just like observation backs this up. Like you feel more welcome, we feel more familiar, you know, and that helps us to like really push forward, right? And I know you have obviously everyone else that's checking this out, check out FeliciaWilson.com. Have a lot of great resources and information for that as well. And I know you have this event coming up in April, and also the second book as well. Is there any other upcoming projects and things that you're working on currently that people should be expecting?
Well, I am working, I'm partnering with an organization to roll out a foster parent conference in 2022. So I'm really excited about that. Also just, you know, landed a partnership for a nonprofit organization where we will be working with them on guiding their mentors to use the What About Us curriculum. I'm really hyped. Like, you know, I'm in that space where I'm just like, wow, all this hard work is paying off. But, you know, you gotta stay focused on the cause and what the issues are to really bring impact and change forward. So that's where we are.
Okay. I'm excited. And if someone wants to connect with you on any sort of social media platforms or even get your email and probably connect further about business collaborations and opportunities, what's the best place that they can go to get that?
So there are two platforms I use right now, LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn, Felicia Wilson. And you can also find me on Facebook and Instagram at What About Us and Fear Everything and Rise.
Okay. Nice. I appreciate you for coming through. And like this is one of those conversations that I feel was very much needed. And a lot of people, you were actually like, I feel like this was one of those interviews that was like inevitable, right? Like it was time for it to come. And I'm hoping like we can have more collaborations in the future. And I'm definitely always down to like support and whatnot. And for everybody, check out Felicia Wilson's book. Wait, hold on. Fear Everything and Rise. If people want to get your book, what's the best place to go to cop your book?
They can go to Fear Rise, FearRise.com. And they can purchase the book there.
So, nice.
2 years out, and I'm still pushing books.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Did you? And one last thing too, like, did you ever see, like, even when you were younger, did you ever see yourself like in this position where, like, I'm able to offer other people that were in my position when I was younger opportunities to like foster growth and nurture them?
Honestly, no. I just always wanted to be a criminal lawyer.
Okay.
And that's what I wanted to do. But after going to school and realizing like they don't pay much, you know, in the criminal justice field, unless you go higher up, I was just like, this can't be the end of life. Like, it can't be.
Mm.
And I prayed on it for a long time. And then I just started seeing God unfold his vision for me. And that's the path that I took, which landed me here. And I can honestly say I'm more fulfilled now than when I first started out in my career field of human services. This platform that I'm on now, I feel like not only am I implementing change and bringing about impact, but I feel like for our young people and alumni, but they also motivate me. You have some amazing young people doing amazing things, and you also have alumni doing some amazing things. So I take my hat off to everyone out there just trying to do something different.
Yeah, that's so true. All right. Appreciate you for coming on, Felicia. Really, really enjoyed this interaction. And for everyone out there, you know, really keep hope alive. I know the struggle. I know it's hard. Hopefully me and Felicia can be a shining example of people who have overcome obstacles and hardships and really just keep on striving for Black excellence, you know, and that could be something that you can look up to and be like, okay, like if they're able to do it and they've come from so much, surely I can do the same thing, right? So that's just what I'm trying to preach here, y'all. And I appreciate all my viewers, all my people. Shout out to John, I see you. Shout out to Crystal. But yeah, we out here. So with all that being said, keep hope alive. Until next time, this is your host, Tony DeRillis. Peace.